Lecture 5, Emma Goldman and the Anarchist Idea of Freedom.
I've chosen Emma Goldman to represent the anarchist idea of freedom in this fifth lecture on Emma Goldman and anarchism, because I feel she's by far the most articulate anarchist of this century. She's an extraordinary theorist, as well as an activist who gave new meaning to the philosophy of freedom in this century by applying principles of anarchism to the liberation of women as well as to men. Now, as we move into this second half of the lecture series on freedom, we've reached the 20th century. And all four of the people that we'll discuss in this latter part of the series are of this century. They're also all activists as well as important thinkers in pursuit of freedom. None of the first four theorists, rather, that we treated, Locke, Rousseau, Hegel, and Mill, none was an activist. They were scholars, they were writers, content to present their theories without leading political movements to put them into practice. But the four figures that we turn to now, that is, Goldman and Gandhi, King and Malcolm X, these are all firebrands of a sort. They're intent on going to the barricades, to go there to lead either a violent or a nonviolent struggle for freedom. There's another way that these four are unlike the first four that we discussed. This latter group are all either women or people of color. They understand freedom from the perspective of oppressed groups, groups persecuted because of gender or race. They're much more impatient than the first set. They want freedom and they want it now. And they claim to speak for oppressed humanity. Emma Goldman is the first woman, the first American, the first anarchist that we've discussed so far, and she brings us into the 20th century by introducing some of the major concerns of our era. We may say that the 19th century gave us three distinct philosophies of freedom that came to influence the 20th century. The first, expounded especially by Hegel, was that of nationalism. It focused on the role of the state as an agent of freedom, and it became an important ideological source of nationalist movements in the 20th century, whether those movements were communist or fascist. It saw the state as a key force of revolutionary change. Indeed, the state became an indispensable force of revolutionary change for these unprecedented mass movements. The second philosophy of freedom, which was expressed eloquently by John Stuart Mill, became that of liberalism. Its defining feature was and is today a defense of civil liberties against the encroachment of both state and society. The freedom of individual expression of ideas and opinions is held as sacred from this point of view, and it is most opposed to the philosophy of nationalism when the state threatens to deprive the individual of his or her liberties and civil rights. The third philosophy of freedom that began in the 19th century and then developed further in the 20th is that of anarchism. And this is expressed best in America by Emma Goldman. Anarchism is totally opposed to any form of state authority, and so it rejects the claim of nationalism emphatically that the state may be an agent of freedom. But anarchism also rejects liberalism, because anarchists believe that liberals just don't go far enough in the struggle for freedom. From the anarchist point of view, liberals like Mill trust the law too much. They rely far too much on constitutional guarantees for civil rights. Anarchists then reject the entire system of government, presently, at least, as authoritarian and hierarchical. They demand instead either a violent or a nonviolent revolution to overturn the whole establishment, and especially the class structure, to organize a free society based on equality without hierarchy. The main principle of anarchism, then, is resistance to authority, because authority, as it's structured today, deprives us of free thought and expression. Now, these were Emma Goldman's beliefs. And in a few minutes, I want to examine her philosophy of anarchism more closely. But first, it's important to understand where Emma Goldman was coming from in her determination to resist authority. And this requires that we look at her own account in her autobiography of her childhood, because it's there, in her book entitled Living My Life, that she describes how she was born in Russia in 1869, and how before the family emigrated to Rochester, New York, when she was 17, she received the harshest treatment as a child from her father, a treatment that instilled in her a desire to rebel. I'll read from her autobiography at some length, because her childhood experience is so crucial for the later formation of her anarchist theory. She begins in describing her early years. My ghastly childhood stood before me, my hunger for affection, which mother was unable to satisfy, and father's harshness towards the children, his violent outbreaks, his beating my sisters and me. Two frightful experiences were particularly fresh in my mind. Once father lashed me with a strap so that my young brother Herman, awakened by my cries, came running up and bit father on the leg. The lashing stopped. Helena, my older sister, took me to her room, bathed my bruised back, brought me milk, held me to her heart, tears mingling with mine, while father outside was raging, I'll kill her, I'll kill that brat, I'll teach her to obey. Another time, my people, who were too poor to afford decent schooling for Herman and myself, sent me to another school. The city's rabbi, a distant relative, had promised to arrange the matter, but he insisted on monthly reports of our behavior and progress at school. I hated this reporting as a humiliation that outraged me, but I had to carry the report back home each time. One day I was given a low mark for bad behavior. I went home trembling in fear. I could not face father. I showed my paper to mother. She began to cry, said that I would be their ruin, that I was an ungrateful and willful child, and that she would have to let father see the paper. But she would plead with him for me, although I didn't deserve it. I walked away from her with a heavy heart. At our bay window, I looked out over the fields in the distance. Children were playing there. They seemed to belong to another world. There had never been much play in my life. A strange thought came to me. How wonderful it would be if I were stricken with some consuming disease. It would surely soften father's heart. I had never known him soft, save on Sukkoth, the autumnal holiday of rejoicing. Father didn't drink much, except on Sukkoth. Then he would grow jolly, gather the children about him, promise us new dresses and toys. It was the one bright spot in our lives, and we always looked eagerly forward to it. It happened, though, only once a year. As long as I could think back, I remembered him saying that he had not wanted me. He had wanted a boy. Perhaps if I should become very ill then, near death, he would become kind and never beat me again, or let me stand in the corner for hours, or make me walk back and forth with a glass of water in my hand. If you spill a single drop, you'll get whipped, he threatened. The whip and the little stool were always at hand. They symbolized my shame and my tragedy. After many attempts and considerable punishment, I had learned to carry the glass without spilling the water. The process, though, unnerved me and made me ill for hours. My father was handsome. He was dashing. He was full of vitality. I loved him even while I was terrified of him. I wanted him to love me, but I never knew how to reach his heart. When we contrast this with the autobiography of John Stuart Mill and the treatment that he received from his father, fathers don't do well in many of these autobiographies, I'm afraid. But this is extreme. And these lines always bring a lump to my throat. I never knew how to reach his heart. This is Emma Goldman's splendid autobiography, Living My Life. She goes on, his hardness served, though, only to make me more contrary. Why was he so hard? I was wondering as I looked at this moment out of the bay window, lost in recollections. Suddenly, I felt a terrific pain in my head, as if I'd been struck with an iron bar. It was Father's fist that had smashed the round comb I wore to hold my unruly hair. He pounded me and pulled me about, raging, "You're a disgrace. You'll always be so. You can't be my child. You don't look like me. You don't look like your mother. You don't act like us." Sister Helena wrestled with him for my life. This is a constant theme in the autobiography, the way she is rescued by women. We'll see how she's rescued by Joanna Gree in a moment, an anarchist thinker. But Sister Helen is an absolutely indispensable source in this family for relief, for tenderness. And it's Sister Helena now who comes to her rescue. Helena tried to tear me away from Father's grip, and the blows intended for me fell upon her. At last, Father became tired, grew dizzy, and fell headlong to the floor. Helena shouted to Mother that Father had fainted, so she hurried me along to her room and locked the door. And so that was how all my love and longing for my father, my handsome father, turned to hatred. After that, I avoided him and never talked to him except in answer. I did what I was told mechanically. The gulf between us widened with the years. My home had become a prison. We want to emphasize that many children, male and female, are treated this way. But this is the first woman that we've treated in this series. And this father is seen now as a source of male authority. And that kind of authority, from Emma Goldman's point of view, will be, for the rest of her life, illegitimate. She continues, I had learned since then that my tragic childhood had been no exception, that there were thousands of women, of children born unwanted, marred and maimed by poverty, and still more by ignorant misunderstanding. No child of mine should ever be added to those unfortunate victims. I would find an outlet for my mother need then in the love of all children. And she tells a splendid story of how she determined to become a midwife, so that she would be at least involved in some way in bringing new life into the world. And she said at that point, I want to deliver 1,000 children. And as each one arrives, I want to whisper into her tender little ear, rebel, rebel. And then she relates in her autobiography of how at age 18, she attended a political speech in Rochester by an anarchist named Joanna Gree. Joanna Gree delivered a rousing defense of a group of anarchists in Chicago who had been unjustly condemned to death for a crime that they hadn't committed. The event you probably heard of in American history, the Haymarket Riot of 1886. Joanna Gree's speech would mark a turning point in Emma Goldman's life, converting her to the cause of anarchism. She relates the impact on her of this speech at that time. At the end of Gree's speech, I knew what I had surmised all along. The Chicago men that had been convicted, condemned, were in fact innocent. They were to be hanged for their ideal. But what was their ideal? The papers called these men anarchists, bomb throwers. What was anarchism? It was all very puzzling. But I had no time for further contemplation. The people were filing out of the lecture hall, and I got up to leave. Gree, the chairman, and a group of friends were still on the platform. As I turned towards them, I saw Joanna Gree motioning to me. I was startled. My heart beat violently. My feet felt leaden. When I approached her, she took me by the hand and said, "I never saw a face that reflected such a tumult of emotion as yours. You must be feeling the impending tragedy intensely. Do you happen to know the men?" In a trembling voice, I replied to her, "Unfortunately not. But I do feel the case with every fiber of my being, and when I heard you speak, it seemed as if I did know them." She put her hand on my shoulder. "I have a feeling that you will know them better as you learn their ideal of anarchism, and that you'll make their cause your own." I walked home as if in a dream. Sister Helena was already asleep, but I had to share my experience with her. I woke her up and recited to her the whole story, giving almost a verbatim account of the speech. I must have been very dramatic because Helena exclaimed, "The next thing I'll hear about my little sister is that she, too, is a dangerous anarchist." Well, Emma Goldman became a dangerous anarchist, an anarchist regarded by the government as terrifying. She moved to Greenwich Village, of course, the heart always of anarchism. She joined with other anarchists there to promote causes such as better work conditions for women seamstresses, which were desperately needed at that time. She soon became one of the most inspiring orators of her time. In 1893, she was imprisoned for a speech that tried to incite the unemployed of New York City to riot. Again, in 1901, she was imprisoned for her radical politics. Finally, in 1917, for opposing American involvement in World War I. As one of her biographers, Alex Schulman, says, "Emma Goldman delighted in heresy, practicing free love to Puritans, atheism to Christians and Jews alike, revolution to conservatives, and pacifism to soldiers." She once said, "The more opposition I encountered, the more I felt as though I was in my element." There's one story that I like that's related about Emma Goldman's influence as an orator. It's about an army private, William Buwalda. He was for shaking Emma Goldman's hand following a lecture she delivered on patriotism in San Francisco in 1908, arrested, court-martialed, dishonorably discharged, and sentenced to 5 years of hard labor in Alcatraz. The general who presided at William Buwalda's trial named his crime, quote, "shaking hands with that dangerous anarchist woman." Buwalda, a soldier for 15 years, once decorated for faithful service, had known nothing about anarchism at the time, but had attended Goldman's lecture out of sheer curiosity. 10 months after his sentence, he was pardoned by President Theodore Roosevelt. Upon his release from prison, he sent his medal back to the army with a letter explaining that he had no further use for such garbage. "Give it to someone who will appreciate it more than I do." And then he joined the anarchist movement. Well, this is a tribute to Emma Goldman's extraordinary influence as an orator and in newspaper report after report. Whether Emma Goldman is speaking in Washington Square, giving forth the theories of anarchism and the practice of rebellion, or whether she is touring the country in the Midwest or in the West Coast, she is amazing as an orator. We look to her as much as to any individual then as a person who can inspire an audience. And we only wish that we had films of her performance. Now, the theory of anarchism that Emma Goldman eventually developed and tried to practice until her death may be summarized, I think, in, well, three main principles. And let's discuss each one of these. It's often said that anarchism is an indefinable political philosophy. And sometimes it's not studied seriously precisely because of that. But this is wrong. Anarchism, it's true, preaches diversity to such an extent that there are so many different kinds of anarchists that it is difficult to find common ground among them all. But in fact, there are at least three principles that they all agree on, and I think that these distinguish the anarchists, as we'll see, from other schools of thought, not only in broad terms, but in specific terms about their thinking of freedom. Now, first, there is the principle of human nature. It's sometimes said to discredit anarchists that they are naive, gullible, because the ideal society that they set forth depends so heavily on the benevolence of human nature, and that humans are simply not that way. They're aggressive and unfriendly creatures bent on hostility and competition. Now, the anarchist's point of view when they look at human nature is that, sure, look around us. Individuals may be creatures bent on hostility and aggression. However, that behavior is socialized. It's not genetic. There is not, despite Freud's claim to the contrary, there is not an aggressive element within us that is inherent and irremediable, fixed in human nature. The point that the anarchists make about human nature, then, is that it's plastic. It's flexible. What we have with human nature is a initially blank tablet, and we try to socialize that tablet in terms of shaping it one way or another. And for the most part, in a competitive capitalist society, for example, individuals are given to competition and aggression. So human nature, first point is not a fixed static quantity. It is not determined by innate aggressive drives that doom us to war and eternal conflict. Human nature is dynamic. It's capable of change. It can learn and grow. Now, this view of human nature is the basis of Emma Goldman's optimism. She believed that in decades and centuries to come, we can learn to be cooperative and caring, to develop a sharing and a loving attitude toward others. She insisted that it depended upon early childhood upbringing. And she devotes so much of her own autobiography to her own early childhood upbringing because she felt that she was a product of that. So when she writes about human nature, she says, "What about, then, our anarchist belief of human nature? Can human nature be changed? That is the question. With human nature caged as it is today in such a narrow space, whipped daily into submission, how can we speak of its potential? But let it be free. Freedom can teach us the dynamic forces of human nature and all of its wonderful potentialities." And so the second of the three principles that we go to when we talk about anarchism is inevitably and necessarily the principle of freedom. Emma Goldman's favorite theme in her writing is freedom. She attacked oppression in all of its forms. She wrote this about her ideal of freedom. "Our true liberation, individual and collective, lies in our emancipation from authority and from our belief in authority. Political absolutism has been abolished because men have realized in the course of time that absolute power is evil and destructive. But the same thing is true of all power, whether it be the power of privilege, of money, of the priest, of the politician, or even of so-called democracy. In its effects on individuality, it matters little what the particular character of coercion is, whether it be as black as fascism, as yellow as Nazism, or as pretentiously red as Bolshevism. It's a power that corrupts and degrades both master and slave. And it makes no difference whether the power is wielded by an autocrat, by parliament, or by Soviets. More pernicious than the power of a dictator is the power of a class. The most terrible of all is the tyranny of a majority. Now there, of course, Emma Goldman has read John Stuart Mill, influenced by Mill to a certain degree, and repeats his phrase because she is convinced that that kind of tyranny can be the worst of all. We are reaching out, she continues, for the wider scope of human relations which liberty alone can give. And now she comes to her precise definition of freedom. For true liberty is not a mere scrap of paper called a constitution. True liberty is more than that defined as a legal right or freedom under law. It is not an abstraction derived from the non-reality known as the state. It is not the negative thing of being free from something, because with such freedom you may starve to death. Emma Goldman liked to repeat the anarchist adage that came to her from the 19th century, when an anarchist said that the rich and poor alike have the freedom to sleep in the streets at night. It's just that the rich don't take advantage of that freedom. So with such freedom, that is with John Stuart Mill's freedom, you may starve to death. Because as we saw, Mill was not concerned about equality. The anarchists bring to the fore Rousseau's key doctrine about the necessary relationship between freedom and equality. So then she continues, real freedom, true freedom then, is not negative but positive. Now note here how she uses, she's well read obviously in political theory, and she deliberately uses the Hegelian terms, negative and positive. Now recall for Hegel, when he distinguished between these two terms, negative freedom was, from his point of view, whim and caprice. And he puts down Locke's and the kind of freedom that Mill is to adopt after him. That kind of freedom is negative because it's simply a freedom that is equated with license. It gives you the permission to do as you wish. And from Hegel's point of view, that's no freedom at all. Now, Emma Goldman specifically says that freedom is not negative freedom. And she again then is putting down Mill's kind of freedom. Negative freedom is not enough for her. It is positive. But how different her concept of freedom is from Hegel's concept of freedom. Positive freedom means the liberty to actually do something. It's the liberty to be. In short, above all, it is the liberty to have the power to take advantage of an actual and active opportunity. So we make this important connection that Rousseau had made between liberty and equality. But even more than that, we have now the concept of power, that is, that all individuals must have equal power, not the hierarchical system of power that she deplores, but an equal power to do, to take advantage, to take the opportunities that they need. So what is she saying? She's saying that, once again, the liberal concept of freedom is not enough. We must have more than that. We must guarantee both liberty and equality. That sort of liberty is not a gift. It is the natural right of man, of every human being, and it cannot be given. It cannot be conferred by any law or any government. The need of it, the longing for it, is inherent in every individual. Disobedience to every form of coercion, then, is the instinctive expression of it. Rebellion and revolution, more or less conscious, must be our attempt to achieve it. What do we have? We have now at this point, then, three definitions of freedom. Among the three people that we've dealt with, Hegel, Mill, and Goldman. And let's stop and give each definition as precisely as possible, as clearly as possible, because we're at a point now as we move into the 20th century where these three definitions of freedom become extraordinarily important for influencing or inspiring mass movements. Now, the first definition of freedom is Hegel's definition of freedom. Now, that is the nationalist definition of freedom. Freedom, according to Hegel, as we've seen, is to know the truth. And for Hegel, the truth is capitalized, as it was for Marx. That is, truth possessed rather than truth pursued. There's no question in Marx's mind, Marx was overwhelmingly influenced by Hegel, even though he threw off the nationalism part. Marx took Hegel's concept of freedom, and there's no question in Marx's mind, too, that the truth shall make you free, and that he had a precise definition of the truth. And what is that truth? The truth is consciousness of God's design in history, an awareness of God's plan. For Marx, it became an awareness of the communist view of history. This, Hegel said, and this is the important part that was to influence both communism and fascism. Hegel's influence in the 20th century is just overwhelming because he was influencing the left as well as the right with his doctrine of fascism. This is gained only through the state, because the state is the agent of God and the highest expression of spiritual freedom and moral authority. That's Hegel's definition of freedom. And throughout the world, at the huge mass movements that occurred in China and the Soviet Union especially, we must conclude that Hegel's definition of freedom has been the most influential in terms of influencing hundreds of millions of people. And I'm thinking especially of the Chinese Communist Revolution. Now, in terms of Mill, our second definition of freedom, freedom for Mill is, and we can state this very quickly because it is so eminently clear, thank goodness, freedom is, as we saw, just an individual's ability to think, to act, or behave as one wishes without obstruction. It's justifiably limited, as we saw, only if that behavior harms another person. And that's it. And now we go to Goldman's definition. Goldman takes this position. And remember, when she takes a position, she takes that position vehemently. Emma Goldman is never halfway in any consideration of other political theorists. So when she talks about Hegel, she said Hegel is not only wrong, he's just not talking about freedom. He's only justifying, from his point of view, from his class point of view, the subjection of the individual to state authority. And that's nothing but another form of slavery. So she dismisses Hegel completely. Even though Hegel thinks he's talking about freedom, he uses the word over again in his writings. He writes chapter after chapter in the philosophy of history that concerns freedom. He thinks he is. From Goldman's point of view, it's a big mistake. It's all a hoax. It's a bogus way to approach the concept of freedom. She says that Mill is at least on the right track, but he goes wrong, and very badly wrong, in one respect, and that is in not demanding both freedom and equality. Because no one is free unless all are free. So freedom for Emma Goldman insists on economic power for men and women, to realize opportunities for a full life. Now, it would be obviously unfair to John Stuart Mill to say that he didn't consider women. We think, thanks to Harriet Taylor, according to John Stuart Mill at least, that he wrote The Subjection of Women, which was a brilliant piece in defense of women's rights, written early on in the 19th century. And it's a tribute to John Stuart Mill that he did that. But from Emma Goldman's point of view, we need to smash the class structure so that we will get true equality. Goldman wanted human liberation, and not just the liberation of women. But she wrote passionately about the plight of women in particular, and she focused on the issue of birth control as particularly relevant for women's liberation. Is it conceivable that in Washington Square, in the early 1900s, when Emma Goldman was preaching and speaking for birth control, that she was thrown into prison for that crime, for describing quite explicitly the way to practice birth control, seen as obscene, and suffered in prison? Inconceivable, it seems to me, from one who loves Washington Square, that this could have happened, but this was the situation then. So Candace Falk, in her exemplary biography of Emma Goldman, F-A-L-K, Falk explains her position on birth control and its relation to women's emancipation. In 1916, she says, Emma Goldman continued to wage the battle for birth control in her own way, assuring readers of Mother Earth. Mother Earth was a splendid journal that Emma Goldman wrote, edited. Emma Goldman said in Mother Earth, I may be arrested, I may be tried and thrown into jail, but I will not be silent. I never will acquiesce or submit to male authority, nor will I make peace with a system which degrades women to a mere incubator and which fattens on our innocent victims, children who become exploited workers. I now and here declare war upon this system, and I shall not rest until the path has been cleared for a free motherhood and a healthy, joyous, and happy childhood for each one of us in this society. We feel her speaking from the depths of her own unhappy childhood. But more than that, she's addressing the vast problem of so many unhappy childhoods. So given the choice between a fine of $100 or 15 days in the Queens County Jail, Emma Goldman, of course, as always, opted for jail. For advocating, as Falk says, that women, quote, need not always keep their mouths shut and their wombs open, she went to prison. She always preferred, she said, the symbolic act of defiance. And besides, she wrote to a woman friend, her jail term gave her a convenient opportunity to diet. In 1919, after Goldman was released from one of her prison episodes, the American government decided that she was just too much. She was too dangerous for this country. And so the government deported her to the Soviet Union, the right place for her, as the judge said. And note, it's unthinkable that John Stuart Mill could have ever been deported anywhere. He was a member of Parliament. Emma Goldman was a true rebel, and she was recognized as such. The Russian Revolution had occurred, of course, only 2 years earlier from this, in 1917, and Goldman anticipated that she would see in Lenin's revolutionary program agreement with many of her own ideals. The opposite happened. She quickly became thoroughly disillusioned with what she saw as Lenin's dictatorship. And by 1921, she fled Russia for Europe. After those 2 years, observing firsthand the Bolshevik Revolution from 1919, when she arrived, until 1921, she wrote a book called My Disillusionment in Russia, which was published in 1924. And the indictment that she made of Bolshevism then in that book turned out to be extraordinarily perceptive and prescient, because it foretold the doom of communism in Russia in 1924. Now, of course, there were a number of people claiming that communism was doomed, but this is an anarchist claiming this, and for her friends on the left, she was not especially popular for making this claim. Her basic charge in the book is that Lenin and the Bolsheviks had, in the name of Marxism, pretended to be acting as liberators of the Russian people, whereas in fact they enslaved them to a party elite and despotic doctrine. Lenin cared nothing about freedom, she said. He wanted only domination, control. At the end of the book, she concentrated on one particular criticism, her view that the Bolsheviks were prepared to use any means at all in order to attain their revolutionary end of so-called communism. And this became a central theme in her later work, because she felt that this was the fatal flaw in the whole revolution, that is, the relationship between means and ends. And she liked the story that an anarchist told about his interview with Lenin. The story went that the anarchist went in to see Lenin and said, Comrade Lenin, we're all, of course, revolutionaries here, but you're just going too far. Even anarchists are being imprisoned. And this was before Lenin literally massacred hundreds of anarchists in Kronstadt in 1921. Lenin, though, according to the story, replied impatiently to this anarchist, "Don't you realize, comrade, that one must break eggs in order to make an omelet?" And then, of course, the anarchist answered with an immortal reply, "Yes, I see your broken eggs everywhere, but comrade Lenin, where is the omelet?" And, of course, the omelet never happened, and that was the problem. We waited all those years in the Soviet Union for the omelet to appear, and we saw only mountains of broken eggs. And that's all that the revolution ever came to. And this was Emma Goldman's way of focusing on the relationship between means and ends. That is it justifiable when the omelet is only promised to crack all of those eggs? So the importance of using the right means to achieve a specific end was stated in Emma Goldman's work in such an original, a prophetic way, that it became the central element in her philosophy. And so I want to conclude with it here as the third and the last principle of her anarchism, that is the relationship of means to ends. We've got then the concept of human nature, the emphasis on liberty or freedom, and then finally the relationship between means and ends. Now, Emma Goldman is not the only one to introduce this concept in the 20th century. It is important, as we'll see, in the thought of both Gandhi and Martin Luther King. But Emma Goldman's formulation is in response to Bolshevism, and this is unique. Goldman knew that Frederick Engels had expressed the Marxist view of the means-ends relationship when he wrote that, and this is the Marxist view, quote, "Any means that leads to the aim of communism suits me as a revolutionary, whether it is the most violent or the most peaceable." I think we can take Engels' words there to be Marx's own words. And this was Lenin's view, indisputably. Goldman believed that this justification of any means to attain an end corrupted the whole idea of revolution. And she wrote about its practice, quote, "A perversion of ethical values soon crystallized in Russia into the all-dominant slogan of the Bolshevik Party, the end justifies all means." And this is in the text capitalized and emblazoned and all the rest, because she feels that this is what we must attend to. In the wake of this slogan, the end justifies the means, followed lying, deceit, hypocrisy, treachery, murder, open and secret. There is no greater fallacy than the belief that aims and purposes are one thing, while methods and tactics are another, and Lenin committed that fallacy. All human experience teaches that means cannot be separated from the ultimate end. The means employed become, through individual habit and social practice, part and parcel of the final purpose. They influence it. They modify it. Presently, the aims and the means become virtually identical. No revolution can ever succeed as a factor of liberation unless the means used to further it be identical in spirit and tendency with the purposes, the ends to be achieved. Its first ethical precept is the identity of means used and aims sought. The ultimate end of all revolutionary social change is to establish the sanctity of human life, the dignity of humanity, the right of every person to liberty and well-being, and the means must be consistent with this end. Today is the parent of tomorrow. The present casts its shadow far into the future. That is the law of life, individual and social. That was Emma Goldman's verdict on the Bolshevik Revolution and why she saw in the early 20s it was a disaster. if others on the left had seen it as early as the 1920s, we would have been saved a lot of rhetoric. Emma Goldman died in Toronto, exiled forever from the United States, in 1940. She had one wish, and that was to be buried in Waldheim Cemetery in Chicago with the other Haymarket martyrs, as she called them. And there she lies today, next to them. She had been exiled. She died alone. And today she is hardly regarded as an American hero. But no American in the 1920s forecast better the basic reasons for the ultimate collapse of communism. No American stated more humanely the ideas of anarchism and stated them with such extraordinary inspiration. No American demanded then more eloquently that this country practice the freedom that it preached by instituting a system of equality. Equality for all its people, men and women alike.